This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. Since the Auditor General released a scathing report on Canada's pandemic preparedness, the Chief Medical Officer has been defending her initial response to COVID-19. It wasn't wrong, Theresa Tam has been saying. The domestic risk at that moment in time for the cases in Canada was relatively low. So the question is, do you buy that explanation? Critics dispute it. The numbers to call 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'd like to welcome Auditor General Karen Hogan. Hello, thank you so much.
Hi, Libby. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, your reaction to my ears, the Chief Medical Officer didn't sound very apologetic about the many failings of her early response.
Well, I can sympathize to some degree. It's hard, or it's easy, I guess, to sit here now a year later and look back and be able to comment on what should have been done differently. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. And it is difficult in the moment to be able to make decisions. And our audit focused on the pandemic preparedness and surveillance and border control measures at the beginning stages of the pandemic. And what we found was that the Public Health Agency of Canada was not as prepared to respond to a pandemic of this nature as they should have been. And one of those items was using a risk assessment tool that was not designed to consider pandemic risk, which incorporates sort of a forward-looking, spreading kind of aspect. And we highlighted that as one of four weaknesses that we found in our audit.
Well, yeah, she based her assessments on just looking at the situation inside the country at any given moment in time, where, you know, and this while we were all watching what was going on in the rest of the world. I mean, I remember, you know, shaking my head and thinking, you know, there's no way this isn't coming here.
Well, you know, one of the items that we did also notice as a weakness was the fact that the Public Health Agency of Canada had not addressed some longstanding issues related to data sharing and health surveillance information with the provinces and the territories. I think that's really a key aspect to look at. One, it's an issue that had been raised repeatedly all the way back to 1999, something that we've mentioned in three previous audit reports in 1999, in 2002, and in 2008, something the agency itself had identified as its lessons learned from SARS and H1N1. And so I think it's important to note that you need that kind of data to identify features of a virus, to be able to adjust your response as needed. And, you know, what you're talking about related to the tool, though, does highlight that you can have all the data that you need. You can have a good tool. You can have machine learning, but you still need human judgment that needs to be applied to all of that to really inform the response. And that's where, you know, we credit the Chief Public Health Officer of Canada for actually stepping in, even though the tool kept saying low and asking for that risk rating to be raised.
Well, it was only after it was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization.
Well, I think that's one of the features in the evolving nature for sure. But if you look at the Global Public Health Intelligence Network, that network issues two reports. It issues a daily report and an alert. And the Chief Public Health Officer of Canada really did react after a daily report at the end of December included a link to a virus that will then, you know, later on become known as the virus causing COVID-19. She did use that to signal a discussion and a dialogue and more action with her provincial counterparts. But, you know, one of our findings was that the Global Public Health Intelligence Network should have also issued an alert, which is meant to signal something more unusual and impactful that really does need you to stop and decide what kind of action is needed.
Well, that organization's highly regarded international alert system was canceled early in 2019 by the government. How big a problem was that?
So what we didn't see that the network was canceled. What we found in our audit was that the Global Public Health Intelligence Network was not used as it was intended to be used. We saw a change in certain operating procedures about who should approve the issuance of an alert. It used to be an analyst, and it was changed back in 2018 to require senior management approval. And following that, there was a substantial decline in the amount of alerts that were issued. Which is why we've told the Public Health Agency of Canada that they really do need to figure out what they want from this network, make it clear, and then use it as intended. Because in the past, we saw alerts issued for H1N1 and SARS, and at the time, they were credited with some of the response in the country.
So part of the problem was that the science people were not in charge.
Oh, I don't know if I would call it a problem. The science people were there feeding information, but it's really unclear why an alert wasn't issued. Was it the approvals? Was it the analysis? It's unclear. And that's why I do think the agency needs to figure out how to use what they want from the network. The alerts are also meant to alert our international counterparts, whereas the daily reports that I mentioned earlier are just domestically shared. So there is also a responsibility about keeping international counterparts informed of alerts. And we saw alerts being issued throughout the pandemic for an Ebola-type virus and a tick virus. And so there are still alerts coming. As I say, it goes back to it's not clear why one wasn't issued when it came to COVID-19.
Your report also found that, Dr. Tam, they failed to update an emergency management plan. The update was due in 2018, as well as pandemic preparedness plan in 2019. Did you find, was that budget pressures? You know, it had been a long time since SARS. Do you find any reason for that?
You know, again, I wish that we could always find the root causes when we do audits. It's not always clear, but you're right. We did find that emergency and health plans were not as up to date as they should have been. But more importantly, that the federal, provincial, and territorial response plan had not yet been tested. And that's the plan that's been guiding the response throughout the pandemic. I think what this highlights is the importance that we should all be placing on being better prepared in prevention. It's something that we all too often don't think about until we're in a pandemic. And we should take advantage of that time between crises to get everyone ready. Again, here, it was a longstanding issue that we had raised for quite some time. And so I do believe that they need to make this a priority going forward. You know, an exercise allows you to identify any obstacles you might have, any gaps or resource issues or capacity issues. And we need to figure that out, not in the middle of a pandemic, but before the next crisis.
Do you think that that department needs a complete overhaul or anything like that?
Well, that really wasn't the focus of our audit to look at, you know, how they were structured. I think that they came into existence following a crisis, and their mandate's a clear one. What they need to do is place better value on acting on known issues. It's not an unknown concern that we raise in so many of our audits and in various topics. Is, you know, no one wants to invest in IT systems and some of those back office things like being prepared. And a crisis just shows you the importance of all of that. And so I think it's just a matter of tackling those issues before we need to rely on it again. And I also think that that's why I recommended that, you know, a countrywide analysis when the pandemic's over needs to be done. A lot of this is key about sharing information between different levels of government. And as the Federal Auditor General, I can only look at federal programs and federal funding. So someone with a broader reach needs to look at the response across the nation and how we can do better next time.
Okay. Thank you so much, Auditor General Karen Hogan.
It was my pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Right now, let's bring in Wesley Wark. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa who analyzed the risk assessments during the onset of the outbreak, and he has worked on the Auditor General's report. Wesley, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the program, Libby.
Now, you have called Theresa Tam's response to this as defending the indefensible.
Yes. I have. And I was surprised by it, frankly. I thought the Auditor General's report into pandemic response was a very strong and excellent report. And, you know, one of the important things, Libby, about Auditor General's reports is that, you know, if they require a department or agency that's the subject of their study to respond in writing. And the Public Health Agency of Canada accepted all of the recommendations and findings, which is terrific. And they've, you know, promised to fix all of the range of problems that the Auditor General identified, including around risk assessments, and given themselves a timetable, maybe a slightly too leisurely timetable to do that from my perspective, but at least they've given themselves a timetable to make those fixes. But then to have, you know, with all due respect to Dr. Tam and the, you know, the terrific work she's done and the enormous pressures her office is under, then to have the Chief Public Health Officer and her deputy, you know, come out and say in a press briefing that the risk assessments, you know, need to be more predictive in future, but weren't wrong. I mean, that just is, from my perspective, you know, it's just the wrong kind of approach to try and defend the indefensible.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I find it astonishing that the entire basis for her risk assessment was what was happening here in our country on any at any given point in time. I mean, you know, you just had to turn on the TV to see what was going on in other parts of the world.
Yeah, when I first got access to the risk assessments, which I did through an Access to Information Act, I was staggered by what I was reading in detail. The thing that they call risk assessments were not risk assessments at all. They weren't really trying to extrapolate from the global experience of COVID-19, starting in China, spreading to the region, spreading, you know, globally as it had begun to do it by the end of January. They were simply looking inwards. And, you know, that was a fundamental problem in terms of the methodology they used, and one of the reasons why the Auditor General calls attention to the need for them to do risk assessments very differently in the future. But the reality is that also the language of the risk assessments was predictive. I mean, they were basing this inward-looking, you know, they were using this inward-looking count, there are X number of cases in Canada, but also, you know, predicting that the risk in the future to Canada and Canadians would be low. And they said that throughout January, throughout February, and they only changed that risk assessment on March 16th.
Absolutely.
There were more than 400 cases in Canada. There were a higher number of cases in the United States. And then we were suddenly plunged into this kind of emergency response, and we'd lost 2.5 months of lead time to prepare.
Do you think that part of the problem is that the Public Health Agency relied too much on what the World Health Organization was saying, and that, under the thumb of China to a certain extent?
Well, you know, Libby, my view on that would be the complete opposite. I mean, there were clearly problems in terms of the early reporting by Chinese authorities to the WHO, which they're required to do under international law with regard to the COVID-19 outbreak. But once the Chinese Central Administration in Beijing really got a sense of how dangerous the crisis was to them, they ceased to be interested in trying to tamp down information, and they swung into action to try and control, you know, the outbreak in China using some, you know, remarkable powers and tools. The World Health Organization was producing information about COVID-19 and its risks that was far in advance of what Canada was saying. And just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about here, on January 26th, when the World Health Organization produces a daily situation report that's available on its website. It's sent around the world to all member countries, essentially, of the United Nations. on the 26th of January, you know, following on the measures that China was instituting in Wuhan and you know, throughout the country, raised its own global risk rating for COVID-19 to high. We did follow the WHO rating until March 16th. So, you know, there's a gap there of 2 months. 4 days later, the World Health Organization declares that the coronavirus outbreak is, it's something that won't be familiar to your listeners' ears, a public health emergency of international concern. And this is an important instrument available to the WHO and built into their international health regulations that were revised after SARS. And it was designed to send a clear signal to the global community that the global spread of COVID is real. It's coming to your country. You need to take preparations. We never even referred to that declaration in any of the risk assessments that we did after January 30th.
Why do you think that is?
That is a million-dollar question, Libby. I think this may sound harsh. I think we suffered from a terrible failure of imagination about the potential impact of COVID-19. We suffered from a system in the federal government that didn't allow us to best react to the information available. And so that's a kind of structural, systemic problem within the federal government. And mixed in with this, I think there was real signs of hubris. And by that, I mean a feeling somehow, and it beggars the imagination looking back, but somehow Canada is going to escape this onslaught. Somehow Canada is really ready for it, even though, as the Auditor General herself has said, we never tested our pandemic plan for the decade before COVID-19 arrived. So, you know, I think we had very high regard for ourselves. We also had stuck our head in the sands. And that imaginative element to say, wow, this is really bad and there's lots of signs that it's really bad, just never took hold.
Dr. Tam chaired the Pandemic Readiness Committee in 2006 after SARS.
Yeah.
So what explains her failure to see this?
I don't know. And as the Auditor General has said, this is not a problem unique to Canada or individuals, any individual in Canada. The World Health Organization has a kind of schematic around pandemics and in cycles. And part of that schematic is to identify what's called officially the inter-pandemic period. That's the period between pandemic outbreaks. And I think it's widely recognized that when you're in that inter-pandemic period, it's easy to forget about your historical experiences. It's easy to forget about the need to, you know, stay on the ball in terms of preparedness. And I think Canada, frankly, suffered from that. There's another interesting dimension to our engagement with the WHO, which is that Dr. Tam was Canada's representative on the WHO Emergency Committee that met to consider whether or not the WHO should declare that pandemic health emergency on January 30th. So she was part of that international conversation. It's a behind-closed-doors conversation that was taking place in Geneva, led by the WHO. But even that didn't seem to have made a huge impact on official thinking in Ottawa.
And how much of it is her responsibility?
It's hard for me to say. And I think I would, you know, step back from that and say, you know, finger pointing probably doesn't get us anywhere. What there has to be, I think, is a recognition that really profound changes have to take place. I mean, you asked the Auditor General, you know, did she think that big structural changes need to take place in the Public Health Agency of Canada? To a certain extent, that is already underway. There's been a huge flood of new personnel at the sort of senior levels into the Public Health Agency as part of that restructuring. It's maybe ad hoc, but it's going on. I think the key thing is to look to the future and to try and first identify really seriously, take seriously the identification of the problems that we suffered. You know, don't try and hide those under a blanket of political embarrassment or whatever, or defensiveness. Recognize the problems. Get to work fixing them, and don't try and fix them just in terms of internal working groups. It really has to be a pretty transparent process of fixing those problems.
And in terms of, I mean, is part of it that, you know, the immediate danger fades, it's human nature, and somebody looks at the money that's being spent and thinks, oh, we can do something better with that?
That's always a problem. Of course, in federal government funding is stretched in a million directions and will be badly stretched in the future, as you know, all of your listeners will know. How are we going to make sure that we're going to apportion enough resources to better prepare for you know, future pandemics, especially, you know, once the COVID-19 current emergency begins to recede a bit, whenever that day is, and it keeps being extended, of course. But, you know, but that's the job of government. It's not to kind of govern in the day-to-day, but also to think ahead. And so very important we do that. And, you know, very, very important to just recognize the fact that we didn't have the systems in place. We weren't ready for COVID-19. Maybe we weren't spending enough money in the appropriate sectors. And all of that has got to change. I think, as the Auditor General says, there will be more studies and bigger studies of this problem as we go forward. The Prime Minister has kind of gestured in that direction, has promised repeatedly that we'll learn lessons from COVID-19 when the time comes. Those big studies are yet to come. The Auditor General's report is a good one, but it's a slice of the problem, and we'll see more.
What about that international alert system? First, I'd like you to clarify, because from my reading of the work on that I thought it had been canceled, and the Auditor General said no, it was just kind of repurposed. Which was it, and how big a problem is that? We learned about this last summer, that this kind of international alert system was not operational, let's say.
Yeah. No, it definitely wasn't operational. It had been shuttered for reasons that remain mysterious, and it was shuttered in the spring of 2019.
Timing is everything. What can I say? Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, so, but it's important, I think, probably for your listeners to understand exactly what was shuttered. So the organization called the Global Public Health Intelligence Network, or GFIN, everything in Ottawa, as you know, has an acronym.
Yep.
GFIN was responsible for doing a variety of reports, but one of them was called alerts. And alerts were single items that have been pulled out of their global media scanning, and they're an open source intelligence unit with pretty sophisticated technology. So they keep an eye on global news reporting, trying to find signals that might indicate something dangerous is occurring in the health security field that governments are not yet talking about. It's not official. It gives us early warning. That system of sending alerts was shuttered in the spring of 2019. It was only restarted in the late summer of 2020, I think, honestly, after the Globe and Mail had done an investigation, it had become a matter of political embarrassment. So why that matters is that the alerts went not just to federal government officials and provincial and territorial counterparts, but they also went to an international subscriber base. And actually, the World Health Organization was an organization that had in the past certainly relied on GFIN reporting for a good proportion of its own understanding of what was happening out there in terms of information you could extract from the global media. So those alerts were shuttered. It meant that no Canadian warnings went out to that international subscriber base at all during, you know, the first 9 months of COVID-19. Why does that matter? Well, it deprived perhaps arguably some countries around the world with an opportunity to pay their own attention to this crisis. It deprived the World Health Organization of a tool, and it deprived our own government of a potential sense of urgency that could have been animated by following these alerts. And there wouldn't have been just one, but there would have been a whole series of them if the system had been up and running as COVID-19 began to spread. So it was designed as an important instrument for global scanning. It was shut down. It was turned into a kind of domestic information network focused on, you know, Canada and the United States and disease outbreaks in those two countries, which wasn't its original intention. So it was really too bad. And that's been being looked at by an independent panel chaired by a former national security advisor, Margaret Bloodworth. And I expect her report, when it's meant to be finished in May, will be pretty hard hitting.
And so what's the bottom line on all of this?
the bottom line is we have to do better the next time. And we may not have a whole lot of time to prepare for the next time. You know, people who are not that familiar with the history of pandemics like to say, well, you know, the last one was 100 years ago, talking about the Spanish flu in 1918. And, you know, so the notion is the horizon out there to really be ready is so long that we don't have to worry about it. But the reality is that that cycle of pandemic outbreaks is becoming narrower and narrower. They're coming at us faster and faster. We've had a whole number of them since 2003 in SARS, and that cycle is only going to accelerate because, you know, we live in a globalized world, and the environment and habitat is changing. So, you know, we have to assume, it may not sound like great news, but we have to assume that the next pandemic is right around the corner. I mean, literally, you know, could be next year. And so, you know, we can't be leisurely about making these fixes.
Okay. a dire warning, I would say, as if we needed one. Thank you so much, Wesley Wark. Really appreciate your time.
No, great to chat. Thank you so much, Libby.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
We are going to take a break. And when we come back, another byproduct of the pandemic, hate crimes are on the rise, and they were even before this whole thing started. A troubling new report from StatsCan. We're going to get a look at that when we come back. Let me give you the numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Hatred against minorities is on the rise in our country. StatsCan has released the latest figures on police-reported hate crimes, which make up only a small percentage of these crimes. And the numbers are for 2019, before the pandemic. And as we all know, the pandemic has made the situation a lot worse. So nearly half of all police-reported hate crimes were based on ethnicity in 2019, with Black people most likely to be targeted, followed by people of Asian descent. And we know that since the advent of COVID-19, hate crimes against people of Asian descent has skyrocketed, but that increase started even beforehand. And when religion is the motive behind hate crimes, Jews are most often targeted. And while the police reported incidents show a decrease, an annual audit conducted by B'nai B'rith Canada reported a record number of anti-Semitic incidents for the fourth consecutive year. And the number of police reported incidents against Muslims also grew largely in Quebec. So let me give the numbers. What do you think of all that? It is not a pretty picture. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I would like to go to Michael Levitt, president and CEO of the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center for Holocaust Studies, Dr. Mary Reed, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto's Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, that's OISE, and Marva Wisdom, senior fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy, focusing on equity, inclusion, and a founder of the Black Experience Project. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us.
Having me. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Let us begin with Marva Wisdom. What's your reaction to these statistics, first of all?
It is very disheartening that hate has risen so much. I thought after the George Floyd killing, the empathy level of right across the country, right across the world indeed, had risen, where people recognized in their own vulnerability against COVID-19 that the vulnerability that people feel through racism and anti-Semitism and the attacks on persons because of their color, creed, religion, or ethnicity, that that's not acceptable. And the vulnerability that these people feel was now being felt by people at large. It is sad that as COVID-19 continues forward, we see folks who are deciding that they need to find scapegoats. And unfortunately, I have to say that there's a leadership gap in addressing these issues, because we know that there's a direct link between the rhetoric of those who are in positions of power, who are in positions to be heard and covered by the media, and those who want to follow them and become and feel as if they're victims themselves and that they have someone to blame. I'm going to share some statistics with you later, but I know these are just opening remarks, so I'm going to turn it back over you to Libby for my colleagues.
Okay, Dr. Mary Reed, and you're a member of the Asian Canadian community. And again, these numbers, they don't reflect the pandemic, but they show, you know, a pretty hefty increase even beforehand. I don't know, and somehow the ground being prepared. I don't know. What is your thought?
I want to thank you for having me on this panel and sharing the space with Marva and Michael. I'm very honored. And my response is, like Marva, I'm very disheartened, but I'm not at all surprised. You know, when we have a society with power differential where people in power operate through a white supremacist framework, this is the result. And we have to stand shoulder to shoulder against all forms of oppression, whether it be racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and we need to stand united. It can't just pick and choose. And we have to realize that all forms of oppression are intertwined. And we need white folks to be standing shoulder to shoulder with us, because if it's just going to be BIPOC folks, we are so drained. We are so emotionally drained. And we're tired and exhausted because of the harm that is being done to us on a day-to-day basis. So that's my stance. And I've got a lot more to go, but I'm going to shut up right now.
Frankly, I mean, what I hear from our leaders, be it at the city, from Mayor Tory or the Prime Minister, I mean, they are very vocal. I don't think that you could call them white supremacists, for sure not. And they very vocal.
This is systemic. Like, they themselves may be very empathetic, absolutely. But it is the systems, it is the policies, it is the institutional procedures and protocols. For example, the police briefings of the Atlanta shootings, that was despicable. The police briefings that highlighted the killer and demoralized and devalued the victims, like, that in itself was done through a white supremacist lens.
In another country.
We are not immune.
I agree with that.
We are not immune. Just because we're in Canada, we are not immune to that.
Okay, let's bring in Michael Levitt. Your reaction to the statistics on anti-Semitism, I guess, the oldest hatred.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate being on the panel with two such distinguished individuals as well. So thank you for including myself and the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center. It's concerning. Listen, it is absolutely concerning. Hate against one of us is hate against us all. And as both of the other guests have so well articulated, it does require us to all stand up, raise our voices against hate. And when we see the targeting of the Black community or the Asian community in Canada, the Jewish community, all the others, it is absolutely necessary for us not just to call it out, but for us to take action, for us to push for change. In the work that we do at Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center, education is the key. Education is the key. We're in classrooms every day, and we can certainly get into more of a discussion about how we're approaching these issues, because, you know, as Simon Wiesenthal himself said, freedom is not a gift from heaven. You have to fight for it every day of your life. And that is the message we bring through the lessons of the Holocaust to children, to students throughout the country, about how they can use that to empower the fight against the racism that they face, the experience that they're having. Because again, these things, they must be accounted for. And of course, we're seeing, you mentioned it, Libby, the pandemic has created a crisis. We know that during times of crisis, hate rises. We know that the singling out of the other, you mentioned anti-Semitism as the oldest hate, and we often call it the, you know, the canary in the coal mine because we see it rear its ugly head in times of crisis. But we know the experiences that, again, the Black and the Asian communities are having. We know that through this pandemic, hate is on the rise. I know these recent numbers are pre-pandemic, but we're just hearing it. You know, that we hear about it. We're getting phone calls. We had a phone call over the weekend about a vandalism of a TTC bus shelter with real, you know, a real anti-Semitic blood libel symbolism on it. We know that this fight is happening every day, and we're certainly committed and engaged in working with other communities to make sure that we are doing all that we can.
Marva Wisdom, and first of all, I also want to point out that this report had an increase in hate crimes against people of different genders or homosexuality or whatever. So it's nobody was spared. Is it just a matter that, you know, yes, people have to blame somebody? Is it as simple as that?
Libby, it's not as simple as that. I totally agree that that's a huge component where people feel that there always has to be someone less than them. They need someone to blame. And I think Michael said it quite well when he spoke about the blame piece. That is a component. I want to go back just very briefly to the leadership piece. One of the issues that we have around leadership is that now with media and social media, it doesn't matter where the leader is. Their impact is felt wherever we are. So even though we're in the United States, what Justin Trudeau might do or what Mayor Tory might do or the mayor here in Guelph, what they might do might matter to a certain degree. But when people turn to social media and they see the immediacy of the hate, and when people start following some groups and then get caught up in a vortex, oh, yes, I have someone that I can blame. I want to go back to the way things were. Sort of the dog whistle thing, right? And how we used to treat others. And now I am losing my position in society. When leadership doesn't tackle that and doesn't call that out, it becomes a problem whether the leader is here or elsewhere. That's why who we choose, who we elect, and who we select wherever we are is so critical and so important. I'm going to give you a couple of statistics.
Okay.
The Chinese population in from 2019 to 2020, Focus Canada and Environics Institute did a survey on race relations. And they were looking at Black people, Indigenous people, and Chinese people. And they were looking at racism and discrimination and how Canadians' attitude toward whether racism still exists in Canada and to what degree. And in 2019, the survey showed that 26% of people generally disagreed that discrimination is no longer a problem for Chinese people. And by the time we got to fall 2020, when another survey was released, it went up to 55%. So there is the hopefulness that it more than 50% of the people, how they responded, they have changed their attitude and recognized that racism and discrimination has become a huge problem. And we see similar trends, whether it be Black people or others, or people of faith. We've seen the trends taking place. So while we're having more racism, more overt racism, we are also having people who are working to learn more, to become more aware. Mary talked about becoming more aware and us working together. And they're doing things and taking on initiatives to help them fight systemic racism and anti-Semitism and homophobia and Islamophobia. They are working to ensure that they're building a better society. So there's the hopefulness that more people now are recognizing and acknowledging that there was a problem. Whereas before they were saying, it's there, but it's not that bad.
Mary Reed,
really bad.
Mary Reed, how much of the problem is social media?
It's a huge problem. I'm not on Twitter anymore because it just so disheartens me and gets me so angry. So a lot of it is social media where you go down the rabbit hole and you end up being on accounts, following accounts that support your initial notion. So if you have racist undertones and beliefs and values, then you're going to be reinforced by people who handle racist accounts. So that's unfortunately that, and there's, you know, there's no vetting process in social media, and you could hide behind anonymous accounts and profiles. So that's one of the downfalls of social media. But then there's hope, like Marva said. I believe there is hope, and I feel like people are uniting and working together in solidarity. I was at the rally on Sunday, the rally against anti-Asian racism, and there were over 5,000 people. And there were people, a lot of Asian people, but I saw people from all different identities and diverse backgrounds. And we were in solidarity together, supporting one another. And I do feel that we, as we move forward, education, as Michael said, is the key. And I'm in education. And that is the main facet in our society that I feel can make transformational change. And education starting very, very young. So I feel hopeful, even though we're in a very dark time right now.
Okay, we've got to take a break. Everybody hang on, please. Before we go to break, the number is 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we are talking about the latest report on hate crimes and also how the pandemic may have exacerbated all of this. And we'll have more on that when we come back on the other side of the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We are talking about the latest report of police-reported hate crimes, which are only a small percentage. And Michael Levitt, you focus on education in the classroom, but what are your thoughts for you stopping the nefarious influence of social media in all of this?
It is an enormous issue, and I actually, as a former parliamentarian, I sit on an international parliamentary task force to combat online anti-Semitism, and of course, it raises the issues of hate generally on the internet. I mean, listen, you just have to consider that it took until late in 2020 for Facebook and then Twitter to actually take a stand against Holocaust denial on their platforms, because prior to that, it actually had a level of acceptance. It wasn't being dealt with appropriately. But we know the rabbit hole that people go down, people that are vulnerable to messages of hate, the people that are fueling the websites that are preaching this hate, that are peddling this hate, are sophisticated. They have algorithms that draw in people, and again, it perpetuates itself on the internet. You just have to look at some of the metrics around January 6th in Washington, D.C. You know, we saw the types of people that were pulled. There was a gravity pulling them towards the Capitol on that day with, Camp Auschwitz T-shirts on as an example. We know the type of people that were there. And again, it's the misinformation, the disinformation, the algorithms that drive you. You type in a keyword search that can then lead you in a whole different direction, and it perpetuates. And I think really there's a responsibility for governments in all countries, and it's going to require cooperation and collaboration internationally. But because again, these companies transcend borders. But there's a real obligation where social media and online hate is concerned for our governments to really step up, work together, and start addressing this toxic brew that exists on the internet, because we see the hate fueled there so often. It's not the only place, but for those that are vulnerable to that messaging, especially to students, as an example, we're talking about the education piece, so much of that misinformation and disinformation just thrives, and you don't have to look too far to find it.
Marva, are things better now that Donald Trump is no longer president and he's off Twitter?
I I hope so. I think our mental health might be slightly better. And I'm saying that because I remember, as Michael alluded to, the conversation that was taking place on January 6th. And I remember standing and watching and couldn't leave the television, but didn't want to watch because I couldn't believe what was taking place. And there are so many people that shared that they were in that same position, that they could not believe that leadership was encouraging this kind of behavior. And I go back to leadership always. And I believe it is better now because people are starting to be a bit more hopeful. But it, what happened had gone so far that it has emboldened so many people, those who have come out of their foxholes and have decided that they have a right to treat people in a disparaging way, to attack people, to physically assault people. That was happening before, but it was an exception for the most part. You didn't find it quite as overt, but now there's an emboldenedness, and it worries me a fair bit. But I do think things will get better. They're really bad now, but I'm hopeful that things will get better because the awareness is starting to be there. And I see corporations, more than anything, before corporations, you know, inclusivity, it's a checkbox, right? Racism is a checkbox.
Yeah, and now I'll agree with that.
Is that it's they're digging deep and leaning in and being uncomfortably comfortable in that conversation, whereas before that was not happening.
Okay, so I want to throw something out that's not in this report and just see what you think. Might be a little bit off topic, but the other ism that I think has been extremely exacerbated through the pandemic is ageism, and it's institutionalized, and it's killing people. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Reed?
So there's intersectionality. So definitely there is ageism, and that intersects. So if you look at the report, the nationwide survey found that 1,000 self-reported incidents of anti-Asian racism, which started, when the pandemic started, ranging from physical assaults to racial slurs, and the majority of them targeted older Asian women. And that intersectionality is really important, but definitely there is ageism, and it's really heartbreaking because in Asian culture, our elders are valued. They are to be treated with honor and respect, and yet they are being targets of hate. So part of that is the stereotype that Asian women are obedient, we're quiet, and older women are weaker, and we're seen as the perpetual foreigner. You know, I'm always asked, where are you really from? Or, wow, your English is so excellent. How did you learn it so quickly? I've been asked that my entire life. When you're asked this all the time, it takes a toll on your sense of belonging. And my intersectionality as a woman in my 50s, I'm now feeling really unsafe. I know I have power and privilege. I'm well-educated. I'm a professor at the University of Toronto. But I am afraid to go outside in this current sociocultural, political context landscape we're in because of my age, because of my gender, and because of my race.
Michael Levitt, what are your thoughts on the age question?
Well, listen, I think it's important to look at the onset of the pandemic and where the highest vulnerability was. People that had their voices taken away, that were invisible, and my mom's 81 years old, vibrant, and thank goodness recently vaccinated. I think, like so many Canadians, when we feel an immense sense of relief when our parents, our grandparents, seniors in our society are finally getting the vaccine. But there's no doubt that we need as a society to have a long, hard look at how this played out in the early stages and how we're treating our senior population, whether those suffering from social isolation in homes if they're living alone. And of course, we know what happened in the care facilities across the country, in Ontario particularly. So these are big issues. So let me say this. One of the things that is central to the work we do, I'm going to bring it right back to education again. Our education experience begins with the voices of Holocaust survivors. It's Holocaust survivors now virtually connecting with students across the country. Last week, I believe we ran presentations with survivors in four provinces, over 1,800 students. And we build on the experience by Holocaust survivors sharing what they went through, the hate, the killing, the loss that they suffered. And then relating that in a universal way, in a universal message about respect, rights, and responsibility, and how that connects to the experience that these students from a variety of backgrounds are having today, how that should empower them. But we know that in the case of Holocaust survivors, their voices are diminishing. Their first-person voices are diminishing. But working in common cause, again, with the communities that are out there facing, the challenges, I think it's exceptionally important to value the voices of seniors and make sure we're taking those voices and using it to inspire youth across the country.
Marva, I'm going to give you the last word, and I have a question. I mean, we are in the midst of the trial against the policeman who killed George Floyd. Where does that leave everything?
That is, because that was a turning point for so many people, it is important what the outcome is. I think the outcome of this will make a difference in whether people continue having that hope that change is happening and change will happen. One of the things that impacted me a great deal in looking at some of the clips from that trial, and I'm sure it impacts a lot of people, is the pain of those people who witnessed this. And when we talk about allyship, when you're a witness to racism and systemic racism and homophobia and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, when you're a witness to that, and especially if you have empathy, it creates mental health stress, not only for that person who's going through it, but for you as a bystander, unless you can do something. And many of those bystanders could do little but to watch that man die and gasp his last breath. The only thing they could do is speak afterwards. And we're asking now for people not to wait for people to gasp their last breath, not to wait until our society is gotten to so low that the vulnerability of the weakest in our society, and when we say the weakest, those who are not being paid attention to, those with health detriments, what the weakest people end up dying, losing their lives, or losing their mental health because we stood by and did nothing. It all ties into the kind of society that we want to build if we don't smarten up and start recognizing and realizing that the system that we are built on, Mary spoke a little bit earlier, and you spoke, Mary, so well.
Marva, we're out
about
of time.
A colonial system. We need to break that down a little bit and build back up stronger. Thank you, Libby. Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Levitt, Dr. Mary Reed, and Marva Wisdom. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.